Did you remember the RM?
Yeah, I'm just going
to
say.
On the food storage boxes? We were going to do it just to play on it, but we didn't. We just put him in the storage room.
Oh, I have a big salon cousin. I have him come over.
It's his old queen-size bed.
You got to pull into the wrong house when you come home, so he can move. This is where we live now.
Yeah, a little tiny shack.
What's that? Was that
Major One? There are
problems.
Well, how was it organized as far as, did they have good sessions? And
they did, but the attendance
is
easily
half.
Wow. Which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, we're a lot more fun at Region 4.
I came to that conclusion very quickly.
Sorry, Your Honor.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Judge Swanger. Welcome to our July 16th Washington Traffic Safety Commissioner meeting. We'll start with introductions to my left.
Okay, I'm Glenn Gorton from the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction, filling in for Mr. Dorn.
John Nesbitt with the Department of Transportation, here on behalf of Secretary Peterson.
Ron Mead, Captain of Field Operations Bureau, sitting in for Chief of Police.
John Snyder, Spokane City Council, here on behalf of the Association of Washington Cities.
Carol Ann Swartz, Grant County Commissioner. I'm here for myself and the counties.
Julie Kimmettle with Departmental Licensing, here on behalf of that poll.
I'm Sandy Mullins with the Governor's Office.
Jerry Grandel, the Director here.
Kathy Drogan in place of Jerry Nelson.
And Shelley.
Shelley Baldwin, Traffic Safety Commission.
Good morning. My name is Etika. I'm a Program Manager at Traffic Safety Commission.
John Muttingy, Lieutenant in the Field Operations Bureau.
MJ Hott, Traffic Safety Commission.
Kurt Schwan, LEL from Federal Way PD.
John Pagel, South King County Target Zero Manager. Wayne Courthouse Smith, Air Operations Manager for State Patrol.
Mike Eagle, Traffic Safety Commission.
Bill Gregg, Co-Chair of the Washington Traffic Safety Committee.
Jerry Novello, Traffic Safety Commission.
Dave Wright, Washington County Target Zero Manager.
Melody Nelson, Lewis County Target Zero.
Evelyn Roy, Target Zero Manager, Chelan Douglas in Okanagan County.
Susie Bradbury, Grace Harbor, Region 2, Grace Harbor, Mason and Pacific, Region Manager.
Welcome, Carol. Has Carol Ann officially been welcomed? You were here last time. Okay. Thank you. Do we have a quorum to approve of the minutes?
No. Unfortunately, if I might just take a second, what has occurred is that there's a tabletop exercise at Camp Murray, which took most of the cabinet agency members today. So, unfortunately, that's why many of them are not here. So,
okay, thank you.
Unfortunately, we'll have to do the minutes. Well, we'll have to do the minutes in October. Not unfortunately, but we will do the minutes in October.
Yeah, and they're very thorough minutes.
Yes.
John, just an update on the pedestrian bike project.
Okay, thank you. So as part of the discussion at the last commission meeting associated with Google Grants, we talked about the possibility of kind of looking for an additional bike ped related focused effort, and appreciate the commission giving us the ability to kind of do that and to, you know, to look at where might there be some additional opportunities. So I wanted to just give a kind of an update on the work in progress associated with that. Staff from the Traffic Safety Commission, as well as the Department of Transportation, got together, really initially looking at just the data and looking at pedestrian crashes across the state, and really wanted to take a first step in, as we look at this and look for opportunities, to have some kind of, you know, data behind it in terms of how we're looking. So we did that, and I think it's similar to the data. I know all of you have seen. It really takes you to the larger urban areas when you look at just numbers and frequency of crashes. We talked about combining that with some of the work that might be in progress, and how do we use this opportunity as to supplement some existing work, as well as looking at areas where there's been success in efforts focused on, in this case, particularly pedestrian safety, kind of took us to looking at Spokane. And we know that with some recent work that's gone on there, there's been kind of a focused effort looking at different pedestrian treatments across the city. We thought that that would be a good place to look at. And with the idea of how do we use some additional funding to so maybe support additional enforcement, and how might that fit into some efforts going on from an additional awareness and education perspective, as well as from an evaluation standpoint. And the evaluation component, I think, is significant from a couple of perspectives. One, as we look at Target Zero and look at different treatments or combination of treatments, having more information around effectiveness. From a Department of Transportation standpoint, as we look at, and this is kind of a traffic engineering industry thing, as we look at different kinds of pedestrian treatments, really understanding effectiveness from that standpoint, and felt like this could help us with that. So that's kind of how we are looking at this at this point. The next steps in this will be some additional outreach. We know that just with some initial outreach, there's interest there, I think, from the city's perspective and from that community, from the community aspect of it. We've spoken with, Chris had a conversation with the Target Zero manager, and she's had some contact with staff there, so I think that there is interest, but a next step in this is to really get with them, meet directly with them, and really refine the scope associated with this in terms of how this might help them. So that's kind of my update. Commissioner Snyder, is there anything you wanted to add to that?
Sure. You know, Darren approached me with this idea, and I thought it was great. It's building on the heels of a few efforts we had in Spokane. We passed the completed streets ordinance a few years ago. We also had a transportation benefit district passed, where we had a 10% carve out for pedestrian improvements. And we've also funneled a lot of our photo red money at the neighborhood's direction into safety improvements. And on top of that, last year we passed a crosswalk ordinance, and I think that's one of the things that caught people's eyes, because we're really trying to not lose crosswalks and lose that safety mechanism for folks and figure out how to support that. I think one of the things that makes Spokane a good place to do this is, even though we're the second largest city in the state of Washington, we don't have some of the resources to bring to bear as maybe some medium-sized cities in Puget Sound, because our tax base and our populace is a lot more lower income than a lot of municipalities here on the west side. So if we try a strategy in our town and we mix it with some things we're already doing, I think there's good reason to think that any success we have there might be something that could be duplicated in other parts of the state. So I'm very excited about it. I mentioned it to staff there. I mentioned to Darren about having Karen Whitten, who's our target zero person in Spokane County, help with this effort. And once we get an approval here at the commission, which we can't today because we don't have a quorum, I'm excited about taking this to the next step and seeing how we can put this in the best place to really get some good before and after numbers and see how this can work.
Mm-hmm.
What is a crosswalk ordinance? What consists of?
So for years, the city of Spokane, every time we redo a street, we sometimes just take out a crosswalk, a marked crossing. And the crosswalk ordinance required us, when we were working on streets, to put those keep those crosswalks in or put them back in if they've been removed, especially if they're in key locations like their parks, schools, or neighborhood retail districts. So it was a mechanism to keep those crosswalks there. It's kind of an understanding that not only do crosswalks show pedestrians, you know, the safest places to cross, but they provide those visual cues for motorists to expect pedestrians there, which is in some ways even more important. And so we're trying to emphasize that with not just paint, but also signs. And we're starting to put in our first two hawk lights as well to have enhanced crossings at big arterials.
So when the Spokane Department of Transportation does their planning piece...
I love how you refer to it like there is one, Darren. The streets department. It sounds good the way you describe it.
Well, that's what I do. I make it sound good. But when they do the planning, though, whoever does that, is the crosswalks not already part of that planning piece, or is that part of the reason why?
They haven't been, and that's been a little bit of a problem. It's been kind of ad hoc. And I'm guessing that a lot of cities kind of have it that same way. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I did is I put a poison pill in our TBD. It's gonna go away, but December 31st this year, if we don't pass our pedestrian master plan, which we've been working on for way too long. Because as you point out, having a plan means we can allocate those resources where they can do the most good. And we just have never had a pedestrian plan.
Mm, okay.
I would just add Commissioner Schneider's comment about using those kinds of treatments and devices to help shape the operation of the roadway and the facility. That is something that I think, at least from a Department of Transportation standpoint, and I think nationally, is a very strong interest area. How do you through different treatments, really get the operation that you're intending to get? That's a different approach. And I think than what we have, at least on the traffic engineering side, like I said before, traditionally taken. And I think there will be a real opportunity here to learn from the effectiveness of that. So I really think that there will be broader interest and that this work could help us just from a statewide standpoint.
Yeah, and this, if I may, really is going to, I think, tie in nicely because we now have, as Shelley will discuss in the legislative report, a pedestrian review council. And so for all the fatalities involving a pedestrian, there's going to be a specific council that will go through and review those, looking at factors and then making recommendations to the legislature at the end of the year. So some of the things that we're learning from that can be combined with potentially some of these. So some of those treatments and how do we do that, and then what can be duplicated in other parts of the state. So it just seems like there's some timing here that's working pretty well. So, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Any further discussion or questions?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Third course, WSP Augmented Season.
Before he gets started, there's a couple of people that came in, Commissioner, and maybe we could just introduce them really quick.
Hi, my name is Martin Mueller. I'm the Assistant Secretary at the Department of Health representing Secretary Wiesman.
I'm Yin Hai Wang. I'm a professor at University of Washington. I'm also directing the USDOT University Transportation Center for Federal Region 10 on the UW campus.
He's not here representing Secretary Quigley. But,
this is item 5 on the agenda.
Yes.
Sergeant Curtis. Okay, I'm getting checked out with this. Okay,
you can fly a plane, but...
Yeah, there's any more couple buttons. It's confusing. If I understand, you were Navy instead of... You were an Air Force. You were Navy.
Right.
We were trained properly at the start. Wow. Okay, I'm Dwayne Courthouse Smith. I've been with the Washington State Patrol for about 18 years. I did 5 years in the Field Operations Bureau, 5 years in the Forensic Services Bureau, and then the last 8 years has been 8 years in the ISB, Investigative Services Bureau, Special Operations Division for Aviation. And so the last 4 years I've been a supervisor, and one of the things that we've been trying to do is to develop a new way of tracking vehicles day and night. And so that's what I want to talk about is how we do that. So beginning of aerial speed enforcement was 1960 to 1989. We basically had a Cessna 172, one trooper, used the old steam engine clocks, plane, and then you had the marks on the shoulder. Basically when those marks came out was we just had a trooper drive his vehicle down the road and we said, okay, that's a half a mile, put a mark out, put a cone down the road a little further, so that's another half a mile. And we do that for 2 to 4 miles. So we track the vehicle from the air like that. Then in 1989, we made a subtle change. We got the Department of Transportation to go out and certify these marks and actually guarantee that these are half-mile marks. The big change, though, so now remember, this was 1960 to 1989. The only change that we've made is basically a DOT marks and digital stopwatch. So not a lot of advancement. So we sat back in 2011 and started talking about this, and we need to make some adjustments to the times. We got to keep up with technology and what can we bring to bear. So we came up with a few ideas.
we started off with looking at the ground technology advancements. How did they make some changes? So troopers, we'd get behind a car and we'd pace them. That's how we catch them. Then we went to the radar. And if you've been in law enforcement and sat in a car with a radar, it's a great piece of equipment, but almost always the officers would end their day with a headache because they'd have this tone going off the whole time to track the vehicle. And then they moved to the lasers or LIDARs, and that's been a big cost savings for us, is that way that our troopers can reach out, point and click, and then get a speed a half a mile away or a quarter mile away. And then they just keep on point and click, and they get constant updates on the speed. It's a very good piece of equipment. So they, on the ground, they made some good advancements. So what we did, we said, hey, we need to get something that we can look from the air and say instantaneous speed acquisition. We need to acquire this as quickly as we can, anywhere in the state. So we wanted all area capabilities. We didn't want to have to use fixed marks anymore. So we could do it on city streets, we could do it on county, we can do it on state, we can do it even on the port of Tacoma where they do a lot of drag racing. You can go out there and get their speeds without any part of the highway. Night speed enforcement has been a big change. Remember, we always had the marks on the shoulder, and we have to be able to see those marks. It was difficult to see the marks and see the vehicles, but now with the camera system that we purchased, we can now do that. So what we did is we worked with FLIR, developed a partnership with them, and we were basically the research and development in doing this. We were the first state, first agency in the country, and as far as we know, there's somebody in Spain that started to do it, but they didn't complete it. So in the world that has developed this system, we tied in the FLIR camera system, and what's called the augmented reality system. It's a mapping system that goes over top of the screen. And so you'll be able to see the vehicle going down, and then it's going across 52nd Street. It's on I-5. It's going past 320th Street. So you can see that. It's on the map that's overlaid onto the video. It's a really cool system. That was something that we set up and worked with our two vendors, and then we brought in two other vendors, and they've all been combining forces, and we've been coordinating with them. So it's been a long process. 2011 started. We just completed, got it going last September, and we've been testing it since. Churchill Navigation is the other company that we work with, and you'll get to see this in more detail, but basically we had some technicians that came in to help us, guys that are a lot smarter than us and talk in a lot bigger words, and mathematician, this guy from Germany, and he was amazingly smart. I mean, what he could bring to bear and gave us calculations on how to figure out distance and time, which I know is not a complicated equation, but he was able to assure us that we would be getting a definite answer that we could be confident that was correct. So on the screen itself, you have a speed. So what we do on the camera is we point the camera at the car. We tap the screen once, it's a touch screen. We tap it again the second time where the car is moved, and then it gives us a speed. So it's a really cool program, and it's pretty simple. So tap, tap, got a speed, and it pops up right here. 75 miles per hour gives us a distance of how far away and the time it took to get that. So this is what the overlay would look like, is you have an instantaneous day speed time enforcement. So this is just during day operations. And we have real-time video. We're recording this, so all the stuff is being recorded. So if there's a question in court that, hey, was it the right car? Did they pull the right car over? We've got a recording of it. We can go into court and say, here you go. And almost always, so far, we haven't had anybody challenge us yet. We've got just under 1,000 cars. We were specifically working in Snohomish County only. And we've got just under 1,000 cars stopped. And we have one case. We're hoping that will go August 15th on a DUI. So it was a speed stop from us, from the aerial speed stop, that resulted in a DUI and a suspended driver's license. So we're hoping that we get a FRI test August 15th. Also on here is we talked about the ARS target speed, distance, time box. Trooper sees there. And then it gives us a date and time. Night. And we'll see a video of this here in just a few minutes of how this operated. But these lines right here show the Interstate 5, the gold or orange. And then if there was any other roads that come off, I can't see, make it out, but this is it's like packed street. And then you have 92nd Street. The reason that's important is, imagine how we used to do it.
We get in a pursuit, and these troopers don't, in the air, we're covering the entire state. So let's say that we're in Burlington, and I got a trooper who doesn't really know that area very well. He knows I-5, but once he gets off I-5, he's lost. So he's taking a big map out in the airplane. He's trying to say, hey, the guy turned right at, I think it's 53rd Street, and then he has to look back down and try to find the car again, and the car's gone. Or, hey, turn right at the McDonald's sign, turn left at the greenhouse on the right, turn right at the big tree. That's how we were doing it before. So now, with this system, we can say, hey, let's say the guy gets out of the car and runs to this house. We tap on the screen, it pops up an address. We say, he's at 322nd Street, address 1421. And it's owned by this person, because we can get the county data, we can pull that up and say, the owner of the house is this, and the guy's inside that house. So we can give all that information to the trooper or the police officer right there on the spot. And it helps us for officer safety. We can also set up a perimeter around it, and we just tap around the four corners of the property, and we start telling where the troopers or officers where to go to secure the area. So here's, we have a pilot in the front seat, and we have a tactical flight officer in the back. The tactical flight officer workstation is what you're looking at. It's kind of an odd picture, but it's difficult to get a picture of it from the inside the cockpit. So what you're looking at is, this is a tactical flight officer's position where he sits right here. And then he has a big screen right here, touch screen, and he has a game controller. I know it's kind of an awkward piece of equipment to have in an airplane, but what we found is that for the new generation that's coming in, a lot of them are really good at playing computer games. And so having a game controller, they can use that to maneuver the camera and switch communications, and so they get really good. So what we're finding is older guys like myself who are in the backseat trying to work the system, I struggle with it. But I get one of the younger guys in there, one of our new troops, put him in the backseat, and he's spot on. And he picks it up so quick, and he's got the controls, and he's flipping switches and zooming in and zooming out. So it's pretty amazing. So screen, we have a recording device. We have a PMDC inside the aircraft that's connected to the State Patrol's network. And that, we'll talk a little bit about that later, but there's some movement with that that'll be really huge and helpful. And then we have the flight deck. It's pretty standard in regards to Cessna 206 flight deck and how you see the front. The differences that we have in this airplane, law enforcement, we have a LoJack system up here to look for stolen vehicles. And then we have a multifunctional display that allows the pilot to see what the tactical flight officer is seeing in the back seat. So when the tactical flight officer is trying to tell the pilot, hey, I need you to make a left turn around the big berm, he can look at what the guy's seeing up front and say, okay, I got it. And then he starts his orbit around that spot, or the Columbia Center. We can, you know, that's where we're going to start our orbit. So the pilot can see what the tactical flight officer is saying in the back. So this next thing is just came out, I think it was Como that put this out, and it kind of encapsulates what we're doing.
State troopers to see how new technology up in the sky is making a difference on the ground.
Most drivers have no idea as Washington State Patrol troopers are watching them during their commute from the air. Well, with this new aerial enforcement program in Snohomish County, the agency is calling the system more effective and efficient to track the worst drivers. Making sure you can commute safely on area highways is Washington State Patrol's top priority.
So this is the camera.
Under a newly developed program, the agency is using its Cessna 206 outfitted with specialized technology and equipment to crack down on the worst of the worst drivers in Snohomish County.
We can target speeders, capture video, and through a time, speed, and distance.
That's day or night with an HD infrared camera and GPS-like data system on board. Trooper pilot Jeff Hatterberg says it's a huge step from the traditional method of using fixed freeway markings and a stopwatch to calculate the speed of a reckless driver. Now it's a touchscreen. Even though you might not see them, they're watching you. I went up with troopers to see the system in action from 2,500 feet in the sky. Within minutes, while our Como 4 cameras were rolling, four drivers were caught speeding.
They will radio to the ground trooper who's working with us, and will stay with that target vehicle until the trooper pulls in behind and actually stops him on the shoulder, and then we'll continue to videotape during a portion of that contact.
Then they're going to call it out to us, and then we're going to intercept it and make traffic stop.
The HD camera is able to capture detailed images like the driver's clothing, recorded to use in the courtroom.
When somebody sees themselves on tape, it's a lot harder to deny what you were doing.
The program has been up and running for 6 months. Now, Homewich County Deputy Prosecuting Attorney says so far only one ticket has been contested in court. The system can also be used for search and rescue, drug surveillance, and other critical missions. In the studio, Paris Jackson, Como 4 News.
So that kind of captures what we were talking about earlier. I think one of the things that you talked about the last part is that we can use it for search and rescue. That's typically not something that we use the aircraft for at this time, because we're focusing mainly on the freeways. But it gives us the opportunity to break away and do other missions that we may not have been able to do in the past. Just recently, we had a hit-and-run homicide. I think it was a hit-and-run homicide, vehicular homicide. The vehicle had parked in the back of his property, 10-acre property with lots of trees and stuff. Police officers were thinking that the car was on that property. So we were able to take the aircraft out and get high-definition photos of that vehicle park, so we could show that there was damage to the front end of the vehicle. It's out in open space, so we were able to do it legally. And so that resulted in an arrest that day, and the guy's in custody currently. So it's something that we're using for various things. We also, the cameras were purchased through a Homeland Security grant, so we are using these to go down and sweep the ports to look for any items that may have been left, like a bomb, or somebody attaching something to one of our ferries. So we sweep the ferry system as well with this equipment. So we're using it for different stuff.
This is heavily edited because it was like a 25-minute pursuit. The vehicle was a motorcycle. Top speed was about 140 miles per hour, 141. You'll see, I think, the snapshot is about 131 miles per hour. I think this was in near Federal Way area. It was off of SeaTac. It came around. We pursued it for 20 minutes. We called the pursuit off because of the driving, and we just stayed overhead, and we just were patient, waited for the guy to think that he was clear and free, and then we swooped in and got him with the troops after he parked his motorcycle. But you'll see how nice it is to be able to track this vehicle with its speed and have it as evidence, so when we go to court, it works out really well for
prosecutor. 120, 130, and 100 plus now, over 120 left lane.
You can see the other cars out there going about 65 or 70. He's leaving them standing.
Yeah, 120 miles per hour into left lane, still going down.
He just blew my doors off, going 140.
Just turned his light off, it looks like.
So yep. We're no longer pursuing.
Motorcycle just blacked out. 190th and Des Moines Memorial Drive, pulling into a warehouse. Suspect's on foot.
874 and 5, suspect's in custody.
Okay, so just keep in mind, this is not the TOPS channel, so we're not, we don't have a helicopter hovering over and giving you great angles of the stop. With an airplane, we use an airplane because it's cheaper to run. Helicopters are much more expensive, probably triple or four times more expensive to
to run a helicopter, which put us at a lower altitude and we get a really good video of it. But so when we get close to trees or something like that, we have to make our orbit and stay flying. And as we're flying, we'll lose the spot of the vehicle on occasion. We reacquire it, and that's just one of the sacrifices that we have to make. But it's and that's what you saw here, is that he was making his circle so he can't keep a target acquired the whole time. But it comes back around, now we got him again. And you, I don't know if you noticed, but when the trooper said it was 140, and we had on the screen right here, it was showing 100, I think it was 137. This is still taking an average speed, so she may have triggered her LiDAR, got the 140 on the vehicle at that point, and we're still averaging the speed. That's why you'd see the difference between the 137 and 140. Also, we've built in the system, along with the Churchill Navigation FLIR, to assure that any benefit of the doubt goes to the defendant in the speed. So we've always truncated and cut the numbers off. So if, let's say, the person was going 99.9 miles per hour, the 0.9 would be gone. It would be 99. Just like we do with the BAC machines. We chop off we truncate it and give them the benefit of the doubt on a lower level. Mm-hmm. So if you blew into a BAC machine and you had a 0.18 and you had a second one that was a 0.175, the 0.175 would be what we would look at. Same thing with aviation. That's what we're doing. We're cutting the number off. Benefit of the defendant. So, where we're at right now is doing what's called a multi-targeting speed enforcement, which is really cool. We're not there yet. We hope to have this in place, so I'm going to show you a little bit more of that. And we're currently installing. We have two Cessna 206s that we're putting the system on. One is completely outfitted with the exception of the multi-targeting system. The second one will be up hopefully in the early fall. So we'll have two fully outfitted systems ready to go. So this is the cool part. It's instantaneous, engages 100 speeding targets. So you turn the camera on, look down the freeway, and then you go, okay, which part do I care about? And, you know, even my three-year-old niece could go, yeah. Okay. So now we've got, you know, you can see it real quick, and then we can acquire it. All we have to do is go, that's the one, touch the screen, track it. Tracker comes on, he starts tracking. We just touch the screen again, and we say, yeah, that's his speed, it looks good, that's the one we want. Or I could have four troopers in the area and say, okay, I got 1, 2, 3, 4. I got four of them, because sometimes these guys like to speed in groups. We got four vehicles all at 92, 93, 94. It's being recorded. We can watch them from the air and get them as we go. We can also, with this new camera system, we can zoom in. We haven't done this much yet. We can zoom in and read the plate. So we can get the license plate. That's how much we can zoom in. If we're about 1,500 feet, we can get a plate. If we're at 2,500 feet, probably not. But at 1,500 feet, we can get a plate. Mm. The camera also zooms in enough where we can describe the driver. If we have the right angle, and we can see what he's paying. The guy's wearing a blue plaid shirt. He's got, he's also wearing a red hat. If we're on the right angle, we can see it. Now, this whole system was developed by the military. Most of this stuff is military. Grown and then it's being adapted. But what this was for the Coast Guard would use this to look for movement in the water. So if say a boat got dumped over and there's 30 people in the water and the waves are moving, the computer isolates and then decides what's odd, what's different about this in the water that's different. So you'd see a body floating in the water or somebody with their hand up going like this. So that's what this came from, and it's been very effective. And I think the cost of that MTI program power unit is about $20,000. Okay, so I kind of went fast because I wanted to keep this limited, but I'd be happy to answer some questions. We are going to be trying to get this statewide. Yeah, go ahead.
What is the name of the company? Is this the FLIR Star Sapphire? Is that who does the...
Yeah, so... We have several companies that we're working with. FLIR is the one that owns the cameras, and that's who we bought the camera system through. Then there's Churchill Navigation, which is the overlay mapping system that we put on the video that you can see, and I can say that's on I-5 and 320th Street. That does that. That also, they also allow us to tap the screen and get the speed. So they work with us to make sure that we have an accurate GPS track that is guaranteed as accurate and certified. And then we also work with a company called Castrol. that was the MTI, that last part I showed you, the little pixels with the, you know, 100 boxes they can put on. And then we have broadcast media systems, which is our downlinking system. We can put this, send it right to a car. If they had a receiver, we could send it to the car, and they could see what we're seeing.
The reason I ask, in Grant County, we're working with a company out of Las Vegas called Huntley. I don't know if you've heard of them, but we're installing cameras and a little different emphasis. We have a gang problem, and we have some heavily active gang areas in our county, and these will actually do face recognition from three blocks away, 4 blocks away.
Yeah, it's nice.
But it's been kind of slow in getting started, and we're trying to figure out why.
And that's a good point, and that's what we found too. It is because we're the first doing this, and so we've run into some issues with electronics. We have to make all these things connect up. We have different systems, and we're trying to loop those together. And sometimes we're going to loop together, and then we'll want to introduce something else into the system, a radio or a sat phone, and all of a sudden now the system's working for that part, but then we forgot that it would not allow us to do night missions anymore. So it's been a long process for us, but it's a necessary process. For aviation to stay viable and to help Field Operations Bureau, the only way we can do that is make sure that they need us. And so we have done, most of our operations have been night or day missions. Our goal is to get this to night missions. That's where we think and believe that the troopers need us out, they're doing, because that's when our pursuits come up, that's when we have more DUIs. So we'd really like to help out in that area. That's what our whole goal is with this. It's a slow process for us. It hasn't happened overnight. We're not going to one vendor and saying, give us this. We're having to work with multiple vendors because they don't know what we want. And so we're having to pull them all together. So it's patience, but we're getting there. Yes, sir.
I believe you said that you had over 1,000 successful. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, just under 1,000 stops, violator stops.
Over how many sorties is that, approximately?
Maybe about 20 per sortie. So quite
that's
a few.
Great. That's
and we're
great
only doing
payback.
Yeah, and we're only doing District 7 right now. Which is Snohomish County. And we started off with a very small part of the county, just working with one court there, and now we're doing all of Snohomish County. And what I mentioned earlier was we've been waiting and hoping that somebody would challenge it, and nobody is challenging it. And now we just got word that we have a trial for a DUI August 15th that may go forward. Now, I don't know if they'll go through the Frye test or not. Some of it, I'm not that familiar as a judge with the Frye test and all the parameters that have to be fulfilled, but it's basically a time-distance equation that we're looking at. So I don't know if it's that complex that it has to go through a Frye test. But
it just refers to a case that where the court ruled that there has to be some, in the scientific community, some acceptance of theories and stuff. And I did one, or they requested one when we started doing photo radar speed enforcement in Clark County, and I essentially held that it wasn't new technology, it was just adapted into a new use.
And that's what we're hoping that the judge does for us too on this trial, is that they come up with that, because that would make it, and once we get that, we want to go statewide. We haven't gotten there, so if that doesn't happen, we're going to probably start to introduce it to Pierce County once we get the prosecutors on board, and then start going from there, which we'll be meeting with the Field Operations Bureau to discuss here in the future. Yes, sir.
I wonder how the speed was calculated and how accurate the calculation is.
We know we've tested it for almost 3 years. Uh-huh. As far as we were using an older camera, which we couldn't certify that camera. So what we did was we basically went out and used the camera system at first, and we were looking at it and we were going, "Ah, it's just not as accurate as we'd like it to be. We want to be more accurate than what we have with stopwatches, because stopwatch, I start it and then I get to the mark and then like that. Now, am I catching the back bumper or the front bumper? Well, if I caught the back bumper as I went across the mark, you still would see it would be 89 miles an hour or 89.3 miles per hour. So we were pretty good already with the stopwatches. If anything, with the system the way it is now, it's giving more benefit of the doubt to the defendant than in the past. But we've done, I believe it was about 300 different tests that we did on it with stopwatch and the guy in the back and another guy looking the camera to identify, here, are we being accurate? And yes, we were being very accurate. We kept that data. And I can get that to you in regards to the accuracy of it. But so we've gone through that process and certified it.
Yeah, the reason I'm asking for this is actually we're going to do a demonstration to the ITS Americas symposium in Seattle.
Okay.
We're doing unmanned aerial vehicle-based video research, try to detect vehicle speed.
Right.
We know there are a lot of challenges because the vehicle is moving.
Right.
And nothing is stable, right? So the vehicle itself
right.
has like various kinds of movements.
Yes.
So,
and we,
this is very good work. It's very impressive.
Right.
But I'm kind of curious to see how the speed was calculated and what's the accuracy and the reliability.
And the Churchill Navigation is our specialist. Those are the guys I mentioned, the mm-hmm. person from Germany who he has a very heavy German accent, and sometimes it's very difficult to understand. But he got his point across, and it was very clear. And he provided us the written data mm-hmm. and showed that it was extremely reliable.
Yeah.
We compared that to the FLIR system, which also has that speed detecting device on board. We elected to go with the ARS system. So we compare and contrast those two
mm-hmm.
and said, you know what, we just feel better about the Churchill navigation system.
Mm-hmm.
So, because there's elevation differences as you're
yeah.
tracking a vehicle. Is he up on a high on a rise?
Mm-hmm.
That's all been taken into the calculations of the computer because we know GPS-wise where those rises are and where
error.
The descents mm-hmm. are. So that's all been taken into consideration. So it's a huge database that we have inside the computer,
mm-hmm.
but it knows those locations just like your GPS in your vehicle. Hopefully, it's accurate.
Yeah, I hope like you can connect me to somebody
Absolutely.
Like doing this kind of work. Maybe we can help on something.
I certainly
yeah.
can. Yeah, ARS would be the one. I'll give you their card.
Okay,
great.
Sir.
Thank you,
Sandy.
Yes, sir.
What's the average length of the sortie?
Well, it would depend on where we're located.
Sorry.
Sure. So
I'm if you're working local.
If we take off out of Olympia and say we go up to District 7, Snohomish, which is usually about a 45-minute commute there, 45-minute commute back, we can be on station for about 3 hours, land, fuel, go up for another 2 hours or so. So I generally don't like the pods flying over 5 or 6 hours, but about 6 hours is
it's a good station.
When we do night operations, we stay up in the air as much as we possibly can because if something happens, say, for instance, in Seattle, Everett, Tacoma, if we're not airborne and when that event starts to occur, it's going to be too late. So we need to be airborne during that time. So even if I've got a guy who's flying the aircraft, he's flying over 405 Bellevue, and are being proactive looking for speeders or looking for disabled on the shoulder and telling the troopers, hey, I got disabled, let's say at 8 p.m. at night, I got disabled northbound Bellevue, and he's on the right blue car. Looks like there's two occupants. Trooper is pulling up on that. So now he's getting that. And all of a sudden, there's a pursuit that's happening in South Seattle. Well, as soon as our guys hear it, we can hear all the traffic going on. They turn and make a direct beeline for that spot. Now they're involved in the pursuit. But if they're sitting in Olympia or if they're even sitting at Boeing Field waiting for that call, too late. It's too late. We won't be able to play.
Other than legal challenges, what do you see as the biggest challenge you face right now? Is there anything that's a long pole in the tent that you're still working issue-wise?
Yeah, I think the biggest one is our whole agency is feeling it. We're low on personnel. In order for the aircraft to be effective, we have to have somebody to talk to. And our troopers, we just don't have enough troopers on the road, and that's causing some issues. We need to get another. We need another pilot or tactical flight officer in position in the aircraft. I'm about two people shy of being able to do this night operations. But without Field Operations Bureau, they have to be the priority. So when we can get those spots filled up to near capacity, then I think we can get some of our pilots or get some crews in to man the aircraft.
Did you have an old Atari that you could work? You can maybe do this as a retirement gig. Hey. Darren, I'd like to see if we can get this. Maybe I'll make a request to you to have this briefed at the fall conference. Absolutely. Yeah, we can. Great information sharing. Yeah, we can work with the chief and... with your captain. Sandy Mullins from the governor's office had a question for you.
Yes, ma'am.
How many Cessnas do we have statewide right now?
Well, we have two Cessna 206s like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to have it. It has to be a 206 that's big enough to use to put all this equipment on. One of the challenges on these aircraft is they're smaller aircraft, and when you start putting all these antennas and sensors on it, they have to be far apart enough or they start to interfere with each other. Mm-hmm. So our Cessna 182s, we can't do it with the Cessna 182s. We have three Cessna 182s, two Cessna 206s. The 206s are pretty much at capacity in regards to antennas around them. We start looking at porcupine after a while. That also can cause some conflict with keeping the airplanes flying. So we want to cut down on too many antennas taken on. So the Cessna 182s would be great, but then you're also looking at, and oh, I didn't cover the cost on this, so probably somebody should have asked that question. So The camera system itself, the FLIR camera, is $530,000. The navigation ARS system is about $100,000. And then the Castrol system is around $30,000. The Castrol, that was the multi-targeting thing that you saw, with the 100 cars you track. So you got lots of expenses. The equipment that's on board the airplane is a lot more expensive than the actual aircraft. So the aircraft is probably worth $250,000. So the total cost of that, of this whole operation, just to have the aircraft there, is just under about $900,000. So it's an expensive piece of equipment, but its capabilities are incredible. And if we were able to utilize the system in a wider capacity, I think we would see a huge payoff.
Well, you think about each fatal, based on the federal calculation, it's almost to $9 million per fatal. And, you know, you guys are able to prevent even just one. I mean, the cost benefit is there. So, and you're able to get DOIs off the road. And I think as soon as you go to the night operation, being able to see, because I know for a while there was some tests there and seeing people and they're watching the lane travel. Yeah. There's, you're able to see things that some of the ground troops can't see.
Sure.
And when we did many years ago with our Ticket Aggressive Cars and Trucks program, you know, we got to the point where people knew where the ground units were. But once aircraft got up, you're able to see things a half mile, mile, 2 miles ahead of the ground units and being able to call them in. So,
right.
You know, not only visually, but now with the digital display, being able to add a whole new technology for the officers and be a lot more efficient.
Right.
And then hopefully with court, being able to keep them having to be going in and testifying and everything else. So
one of the things that, Kevin, you brought up that I wanted to talk about too, we used to have what's called the Metro program back in 2000. 2000, we started the Metro program. We fly over Seattle, Bellevue, and Everett. And we just basically did this wide 405 I-5 loop. And our job was to identify when there was a call for service, we would swoop in from the aircraft. We'd say, yeah, that collision actually is at I-5 northbound at Lake City Way, or it's northbound, so, or it'd be at southbound. What we found with a lot of troopers, we'd get these calls that say, hey, it's just north of Northgate. And so we'd have a trooper take that exit to come north, just north of Northgate, and it was actually south. So now that trooper has to go all the way up to 145th, make a turn, go all the way back down to 85th, get back on the turn, and then get in behind the vehicle, and that was there. So we just wasted 20 minutes. Now, you all been in Seattle traffic, and you know what happens when there's a collision or a delay that's 20 minutes long than it needs to be. So you get a huge backup. We're having the aircraft in the air with all these capabilities, and now, I didn't mention this earlier, that's why PMDC, the computers inside the cars that the troopers can look at, we had that in the aircraft. We're working on getting it so that we can, in the aircraft, I can see what trooper is out there. If there's a trooper sitting at 145th, I will get his badge number and I can call him direct and say, hey, 641, I've got a disable or blocking disable that north gate. Can you turn? If you make a left turn, you'll be there in 2 minutes. And I can directly talk to him, identify who that trooper is, and get him on his way, which I think is going to be a huge benefit once we get that. So anyway, with the Metro part, we went to the Metro. We did the Metro daytime operations. We did it in the morning for commute, and then we did it in the evening commute. And we were very effective. We kept data on that. And then we switched over, and we went to Target Zero Initiative, started looking for drunk drivers at night with the aircraft. And we did that for 2 years. We had great data to show how effective it was. But as we started losing troopers and our budget got cut, we had to do away with that program. So as we start to grow or hopefully get some budget back and get some troopers back here, and we can reinvigorate that program. So that's one that we're really hoping to get acquired. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Any other questions? I have a business card. I can certainly hand to you if you wanted to contact me and get some more information. I also have the PowerPoint I can send to you via email.
Great.
Or in the mail. I have some DVDs at my office I can send to you so you can see the whole PowerPoint.
Did you want one?
Thank you.
Okay. That would be awesome.
All right, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Amazing. I think one of the reasons people aren't challenging anymore is, you know, way back when, because I was doing these late 70s and 80s as an attorney or as a prosecutor, people would say, well, how do you know those markings are that distance, or how do you know the stopwatch works? But now everybody, you can watch TV and movies and you're aware of all this technology, and so it's kind of, I think a lot of times people are saying, oh, okay, they got it.
Well, you know, we know it works. I mean, I hate to, we're not supposed to use the military as an example much for law enforcement, but if you watch a moving vehicle driving in the middle of a desert and he's going 100 miles an hour and we can put a missile that's shot 200 miles away on that target, if we have those capabilities now, and it's been proven over and over and over again, we certainly have the capability to track a vehicle with speed and be confident that we're getting the right speed by tapping the screen. The GPS is that accurate, and so it's just making that switch to the accuracy and believing it, and it's been proven time and time. Believe me, I was stationed in Iraq. I saw the results of it. It was very effective.
Professor Martin.
Packet Trans Partnership.
While he's setting up, I think that we could afford a few for, you know, chronic violators. We could put the missile on the target. Especially those in pursuits.
So, would we send you the list, Darren, or would you like me to send it to the sergeant?
Oh, I'll let you go directly to the sergeant. No, but it's great technology, and it's, you know, that's why I wanted to have this body be able to see that. When we I was at the International Association of Chiefs of Police Highway Safety Committee, which I'm a member of, and when you presented, I immediately wanted to have him be able to present to the commissioner so they could see what is actually going on and some of the technology that's available out there. So
we can take this to the Grant County, the other counties, and get out when they have the big events that are going on, Spokane, Poop Fest. Mm-hmm. When they have those big events, we can come up with the aircraft, station it there overnight, do that operation, support it, and then fly back, mm-hmm. and the other counties as well. So that's why with this equipment, I have to rely on those partners.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
So first of all, let me ask, how many of you know PacTrans? A couple of you. So let me give you a good introduction about what this is. And we are willing to help, and we have the research capability, and the very motivated students actually could help on something. Let me give you a brief history about the University Transportation Center program. Actually, the regional UTC has been in the University of Washington over the past 27 years. So we were among the earliest UTCs, like launched in 1987 under the Surface Transportation Uniform Relocation Assistance Act. In 2011, because there are too many UTCs and USDOT decided to close all of them and open for recomputation. So they opened for like 22 university transportation centers, 10 regional and 12 tier one. Each regional center will get $3.5 million per year for research, education, workforce development. And tier one center will get like also $3.5 million in this particular computation. We win this computation, and later on, so they close those and try to do another computation defined by MAP 21. In this one, there are a total of 35 centers. 5 national centers, 10 regional centers, and also 20 tier one centers. So we win this regional center again under MAP 21, and this time our center focused on transportation safety. So here's the distribution of the 22 centers. So we got $3.5 million a year, and the most recent computation we won, $2.6 million a year for the regional transportation centers. And there are a total of 35 centers around the country. So we're in Region 10, and Region 10 includes Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. So our consortium includes 5 universities, and the University of Washington being the lead. We have Oregon State University on behalf of Oregon, University of Alaska Fairbanks on behalf of Alaska, and Idaho, University of Idaho on behalf of Idaho. We have another major research university in our state, Washington State University, has been our partner over the 27 years of the UTC history. So we have a very strong representation of Washington in this consortium. We have external advisory board and also the board of governors, board of directors. The board of directors will be the decision-making unit. So we got proposals or other suggestions of activities decided by the board, implemented through the director, assistant director. We have research committee, education workforce development committee and task force. We also have the outreach and technology transfer task force and the student leadership council. So we organize annual meetings for Region 10 transportation professionals. We also have student meetings the second day. So we try to bring researchers from the entire region come to the University of Washington, talk about their cutting-edge research, talking to the professionals, the practitioners to see how their research may be used. So we actually have a very good workforce development program, and I think John Nisbet went through that, and we tried to reestablish it. So that one was stopped because I think WashDOT lacked funding, whatever. But now we really want to reestablish it because we see a lot of leaders in WashDOT now actually graduating through that program. The PACTRANS team includes staff members and associate directors for different areas. Like Linda Boyle, she is also the department chair for industry and system engineering department at University of Washington. She is in charge of research and herself is a traffic safety researcher focusing on human factors. Ed Mudon, she is an urban planning professor, study a lot of pedestrian activities and also how people's travel behavior affects people's health. And she is in charge of our education program. And Mark Hellenbeck, he is the director of Washington State Transportation Center. He is also associate director in outreach. Maria Bayer is the assistant director in PACTRANS. She is in charge of the daily operations, and then we have multiple staff members supporting her, including Alice. She's actually doing like our newsletters, annual report, website maintenance, etc. For the other four consortium university partners, we have one person in charge on each campus. Chris Bell is associate director at Oregon State University. Billy Corner, he is the director of the Alaska Transportation Center. He is also the associate director at University of Alaska Fairbanks. Ahmed is the associate director at University of Idaho. He is also the director for Idaho Center, University Transportation Center, called NIAC. They do a lot of good work in traffic control. And Ken Casavant, he's a professor in agriculture economy, have done a lot of work about logistics, and he's our associate director at Washington State University. So through these all consortium partners, we have over 100 PIs involved. So we have pretty strong research strengths, and people are in different areas, like policy, planning, engineering, information technology. So we really have a very strong, very good research task force. PACTRANS also have a very close relationship with all four state Department of Transportation, and we have their research office director on our advisory board. This is actually Michael Baffolino. He is the research office director at Oregon Department of Transportation. And this is an older photo. Lenny was the WashDOT research office director, but now is Rhonda Brook. We also have Toyota's vice president serving our board, giving us some advice. And also private company representative like Vin Ketelsen. He owns his own company, very successful. So we try to build a very strong partnership. Actually, we did not know Washington Traffic Safety Commission until we are facing the second competition. I thought we should have some agency here focus on safety, and I searched and I found there. And then we try to build a stronger connection because our focus aligns really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
Our center's theme is data-driven solutions and decision support for safe transport in the Pacific Northwest. The center is safety and sustainability, and our approach will be users, vehicles, system network, roadway, and environment. We consider all these things are very important for us to develop safe and sustainable solutions that supports the safety goals. Our strategic direction has been trying to address the challenges of all these three key things, like energy, environment, and transportation. Maybe you know, like, transportation consumes about 70% of the oil, but the fuel efficiency is only about 16%, which is the lowest. And the President Obama wants to double the energy efficiency. That means transportation will be a key area try to reach this goal. So our center will try to promote data-driven solutions for scientific understanding and informed decisions. Informed decision means like you use the data you can get and try to make a good support of the kind of decisions people want to make. Develop new technologies for better sensing and monitoring of transportation infrastructures, and also train transportation engineers with strong technology and data handling skills. Because from the federal's Transportation Workforce Challenge report, they identified data scale as being the most important thing for the future engineers in transportation area. So we want to make PacTrans the research engine for our region. We also want to be the applied technology showcase. We try to make our research useful, not just to publish a paper, put it somewhere. Because we are engineering professors, we should target solving some critical problems, particularly the safety problems. Workforce development base, education leader, and also the collaboration platform. We try to make our regional conference as collaborative as possible. So we have different sessions focusing on workforce development, educational needs, what are the key issues that we're facing, and how we can develop solutions for those important things. Here's a brief overview of our funding sources, and this somehow representing the partnerships we already have. So the US DOT requires one-to-one match. So that means US DOT funding is 50% in our total funds. We have about 5% from public transportation agencies, except state DOTs, and 5% from private companies. And state DOTs provide 30% of the total match funds, and another 10% from the university. In terms of the spending, we have about $3 million average over the past years. The US DOT funds, if you consider also the match funds, that's $6 million total. We have about 57% of the total money spent for research. Education and workforce development cost us 21%. Outreach tech transfer is now 14%, and the remaining 8% is for administration. If you have any questions, feel free to stop me. Darren gave me 20 minutes, and I tried to find the best to keep it. Because I'm not exactly sure what you want to know and what you have already known, so I prepared everything. But if something you already know, we can skip it. The kind of research project we are supporting includes the regular research project, education project, and outreach project. So these are the multi-institutional projects. So we try to make the universities sitting in different locations work together so we can find the common issue, and that's more likely to be the regional important issues. For the regular research project, we put actually $200,000 each, but we reserve $20,000 to use after the project completes, and we try to fund the tech transfer effort. So we have also smaller project, a single institutional project, we give $120,000 each institution, and they may fund projects between $30K to $60K, addressing something very important, but not yet at the regional level, or something too early to form up a bigger team to do the research.
There are a lot of educational challenges. For example, how do we do a better job for teaching our junior level transportation courses? There are a lot of overlap work, and we want to share the good work. So we have a team together, develop different modules, and we make the module available, and people teaching similar course at different universities can work together, make a good use of the module. An outreach project, we identified, in our first project, we identified distracted driving for the teenagers. And we have five universities all participated. We outreached to high schools, gave them lectures, tell them the harmfulness for driving and texting and a bunch of other distractions. And we got, our effort got highly appreciated by the high school people, and they wrote appreciation letters and also support letters for our center's new computation. And the most recent project we funded along the outreach line is the late departure crashes, considering like DUI and other factors. We have a lot of studies focusing on like alcoholic drinks impact on driving, but very few on marijuana's impact. So people have an interest to study those kind of factors. For the selection of our project, normally we host an annual transportation safety workshop. And Chris, he delivers speech and talk about the vision from our state. We also have federal people talking about federal vision, how we can work together along the most important lines. And this picture shows actually the panel of the agencies talking about what they consider important from their own state. And then we come up with a list of important topics for us to study. And in our call for proposals, for example, out from the workshop, we identified like performance evaluation tools of safety projects, safe travel on mixed use roads, and the technology impacts on safety. These are very important things, and we list these things as the focus for the new call for proposals. So once we receive all the proposals, we'll send out to the external experts for review. So normally we send this to three external experts, and also the agency who is interested to match. And we will also get this agency's opinion about if this is important or not. So after we have all the projects selected, this will be in our regular research track, and we ask them to do semi-annual reporting, their progress of research, what they have done in terms of the research, education, and also outreach. How do they plan to transfer the technology developed in the research to the practice? So here I want to give a little bit the example. Like we have a lot of research going on, and I can do a better job for the research I'm doing. And so I pick up two examples that I'm involved. One of them is actually how do we detect pedestrians? So pedestrians are very hard to detect because most of the sensors we designed so far are for detecting vehicles, some kind of metal on the road. For pedestrian, if we use video, you know, this is actually have a lot of occlusions. When pedestrians' density is high and they are occluded, it's very hard to separate pedestrian. But we are making use of the 3D sensor, which is the Microsoft Kinect sensor, like you play Xbox game. So this one actually measures not only the regular 2D image, but also a depth sensor, measuring how far are you from the lens. So in this way, like the dots, actually even this looks like all one object if you do background subtraction. But we know these are very different distances, so we can easily separate them out. And this methodology has got pretty good accuracy, and we are seeking for the next step of development to make this more useful. And there are also a lot of interest for detecting pedestrians or bicyclists at intersection areas because USDOT make pedestrian safety as their top priority. But we really do not have a lot of pedestrians data, like where those people show up and how often do they conflict with vehicles or other like transportation means. We developed some video program, try to detect how long pedestrians cross the road and how long they waited until they run the red signal.
And also on the shared pass road, this is Brook Gilman Trail. So how many bicyclists are using it? How many pedestrians are using it? And what are the speed differences for these different kinds of traffic? Now the city of Bellevue is asking us to help them try to get the data, like the conflict data of their bicycle flow and this right turn vehicle flow at this like 116th and the NE 12th Street. They also want to know better about the conflicts at the intersection of 148th and the Main. And this one, they're interested to see like when the pedestrian, the bicyclist make a right turn. So how close are they to the traffic? So these are possible by doing automatic video analysis, but there's still a lot of challenges. We're not facing this challenge because we have a PacTrans project going on, and Bellevue showed strong interest to work with us on this, and we say, okay, we'll select Bellevue, try to do this research, and we can benefit the local agency while we get better data support. So I think this kind of partnership is what we're very actively seeking for. Another way of collecting pedestrian data, this is another research work we are doing at the University of Washington. You know, everybody has a smartphone. Now your smartphone have Wi-Fi and have Bluetooth, and in most cases, like your Bluetooth is in the discoverable mode because I have my Bluetooth earphone in my car. When I'm out of my car, I normally do not turn off my Bluetooth function. So in this case, we built a phone app. And this phone app, if you have this phone app, you are a data collector. When you're walking around, this is UW Red Square. This blue circle actually shows the person carrying the smartphone app. And this smartphone app can scan the surrounding MAC addresses, like the signals, Bluetooth or Wi-Fi, and then record the time this particular MAC address is detected. And this data will be sent back to the server, and the server provide a match, and then we know, oh, this particular person was captured here, and then detected again in another place. And you look at the distance, the time, you can try to make a guess about where these people are going. So this is actually, all the yellow dots are showing the MAC addresses detected. You can consider each MAC address as a kind of an electronic device. Maybe I'm carrying two phones and I will have two MAC address, okay? But each MAC address is also unique. But if you link the same MAC address, they look like spaghetti. This is not the true path, right? So we have to do like estimates using the methodologies, try to guess what's most likely the path the person used. So you have to combine the data you got on the university's map, and we got a pretty good result, but depends on your acceptable confidence. You can get a different number of trajectories identified. So this is still active research going on, but this certainly offers a good way of collecting pedestrian data with almost no cost. So this is something we are very interested in doing. The last example I want to show you quickly is actually about how to make a good use of the data available. And we got a lot of data from Washington State Department of Transportation. Actually, I've been working together with John Eastman about the SHARP-2 L38 project, trying to calculate travel time reliability. This one is actually the level of services. So often we got a question like, we give you this much money, after you use the money, what's the improvement of the network traffic? So USDOT folks always talk to me about this. I said, I got a solution for you. This is actually a big data system based on a location, like a digital roadway map. So we can calculate the level of service at any roadway segment, and we can integrate the calculated result to give you an index for the network. So before your project and after the project, you can compare during the peak hour, during the off-peak hour, what's the improvement, right? So you can give a quantitative result rather than I think it's better. I think it's better is very hard to understand. So this is actually a very solid quantitative way of doing that. And we're also helping WashDOT to actually produce their congestion report. So it used to be several people work for multiple months to get that done. Now they click a button. No matter who comes to collect it, they got the same result, right? And it's quick in multiple seconds. This one shows like of the incidents occurred on the roadway. they cause different level of congestions. But based on the traffic flow data and also when the incident occurred, we have the methodology to calculate incident-induced delay, which means how much delay is because of this particular incident. And that's a very good way for calculating what is the indirect cost for this particular incident, including traffic accidents. Now we're working on a statewide safety analysis. So this is actually I-5 corridor. We can see how many incidents observed. And based on the highway safety manual, this is the equation. If you use this equation, you calculate how many incidents are expected. If you see a particular segment has way more incidents than expected, that's the hot spot. We have to spend some effort to investigate what happened and how to address it. So this work is still ongoing, but we will be completing this in multiple months, and I hope this will be useful for Darren's commission. So we also spend our effort trying to outreach to the potential users. Like, we are demonstrating our pedestrian detection using the Kinect sensor at the Seattle Expo, Technology Expo. And we also do this in the ASHTO Information Subcommittee meeting. And our outreach project has been generated a lot of interest and impact. So this is actually David Herb, one of the participants of the research from Oregon State University. He's receiving a TV interview talking about what he found. And the research team is putting together an article. I think the article is ready for publication. So our previous efforts also resulted in some very good projects, like this one, like Green Roads project, actually started with the UTC funding. And this one received the White House Champion of Change in 2013. Mm. For the new Patrons project, it's too far, it's too close to say all these big things, but I think they're on the way to get to the very recognized research outcomes that's potentially useful for our society. So with that, I just want to conclude my introduction. If you have any questions, feel free to let me know.
Yeah. So, where would one find kind of a compilation of some of the research or publications or papers or different things that you've produced if you're looking to find data or information in a certain area?
We have our research reports published on our website and also upload all our research reports to the USDOT's database. So, for research report, that would be the best way to find. For research papers, we did not gather all the papers from these people and put in one place. But normally, you can see these people's paper from their online CV. If you see a particular paper you're interested in, and you may be able to find it online to download, or you can let me know, we can help you to get a paper.
Okay. Thank you.
So yeah. How can we, I see this question very much, how can we, this is, very exciting, very cool. How could we as a state commission be a bit of a dating service if John's got a pedestrian service or a pedestrian plan in action, but you might not have the academic or the pracademic or whatever we're going to call it that's got this kind of background, that maybe you're looking for someone to review what you've got going on, or you're looking to do a specific body of work, and this is a good group of folks, I think, that know what's going on in the state. It seems like we could have a good match.
Absolutely. This is exactly why I want to come here to do this presentation. And also, after I found the Washington Traffic Safety Commission, we started to invite them to our seminars, to our workshop. Yeah. And Darren and I, we have met several times, and also Chris. We started to talk about what is important in his agenda, what is important and the resource available on our side. Maybe we can do some joint call. Let's say Washington Safety Commission consider this is a very important issue. Let's try to leverage the resource to do a better job on this. Maybe we can say call for proposals for this with some funding from Patron and some funding from Washington Traffic Safety Commission. I think this is a much better way of doing research than researchers close the door or try to think what is important. So I keep telling my colleagues, it's very important to go to talk to people to see what is needed rather than you produce a bunch of equations that nobody wants to use.
Yeah.
Yeah.
and we need that tracking system to, I mean, I was thinking about how what you're talking about is the value of, you know, outfitting the Cessnas. And if you could use something like your tracking system as far as what is the impact of clearing traffic quicker, getting more DUIs in a specific area. I mean, it seems like what you, the research you've applied to justifying federal funding also works at the state level to justify more.
Absolutely. There are a lot of potentials. I think the work I've been doing with the support from John has been a useful tool, a platform for doing the analysis of congestion spots, how many congestion spots in a particular roadway network. When do they start? Do they start every Tuesday or maybe only Monday and Thursday, whatever? So we will be able to make a very good observation than just look at a particular road segment. Today is okay, and tomorrow may be congested. Maybe we can figure out this is because there are two congestion spots, they are correlated. If the upstream one is congested, there's no congestion downstream. If the upstream one is okay, and this one will be congested. There are a lot of these kind of scenarios. But if you do not do a large-scale system analysis, it's very hard to identify that relationship. So like the flow map I showed you has over 10,000 loop detectors. And each day, my lab receives 43 million lines of data. So we have to manage these data, put into the right place, do the data quality control, put them into the right platform, and calculate and show. So I think, certainly, I think if a particular agency has some data to contribute, it's going to be very helpful for us because the more data you have, the more powerful your analysis result will be. And like the research work we are doing for using the UAV, if the UAV is okay to deliver like the Amazon products,
right,
why not we use the UAV to collect traffic data, even do the enforcement? I did not think about enforcement until mm-hmm. I saw what you are doing. I saw, oh, the work we did may be helpful for actually identifying the speeding vehicles in a particular place. You send a signal, right? And then you can trigger maybe a state patrol people get to there to see what's going on. And this is much cheaper. UAV is like, we have UAV, is only $200. It's pretty good. So it's getting very, very low cost.
Right.
And the research work we are trying to do is just regular camera. Not as
bad. So you need signal on it.
Yeah.
So anyway, any other questions?
Hey, Dr. Wing, back in 2003, 2004, we worked with Dr. Hollenbeck at the University of Washington to help us, when the roadway is blocked, to determine what costs, let's say it's closed for 5 minutes or 4 minutes, and how quickly we get a trooper to the scene, delay. But we couldn't get any updates on, as things have changed and the traffic has gotten heavier and heavier, what calculation we would use to determine the costs for that. Would that be something that with this PacTrans group would be able to provide now, or is...
I think we can do a lot more than before because of the computing technology improvement. And also myself has both computer science background and the transportation background. I actually got an offer from Microsoft. I choose to stay because I feel more interesting in doing intelligent transportation system than being, they call it like the cold farmer. This guy writes code all the day. We have a lot of good connections with Microsoft. They're also interested in our video work. We'll see how we can work together, try to use their technology, address the problem, we understand better.
So would there be a point of contact? Would Dr. Hollenbeck still be the right point of contact?
Mark is the transportation center. He's not the faculty. So he's not the professor.
Okay.
But Mark's been doing a lot of this kind of work. He knows very well about the roadway system. But you can ask your person to start with me. I will see who may be the best person. Depending on the question, I may help you to find the best professor or the best postdoc for all.
Thank you, sir.
But I think in general, with that big data platform, we'll be able to calculate things very quickly and more accurately. Let's say, like, if we discussed about the Alaska Conway Viaduct, right? To do to reconstruct this or put this underground or make it a surface grade. So there are scenarios that Alaska Conway Viaduct was blocked, like closed due to some reason, right? If you are able to observe, during that time period, where are vehicles going? Which street get worse? Which street is okay? you can imagine if you do not have this, only have the surface street, that's going to be the scenario, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that big data platform certainly gave us a lot of opportunity to observe some special scenarios, very difficult to test, but maybe already happened in some time period due to whatever reason, and you have the data reported, you can recall to visualize what happened.
So do you have some business cards that you could disseminate
sure.
to some of the folks here,
and
then we can
cards,
we'll have his contact information sent out to you in the minutes and stuff, so that way you can get the papers and any of the research that you're interested in. So
yeah.
I have been very jealous over the years of my colleagues who have direct connections with universities. My counterpart in Tennessee is part of the University of Tennessee. So when we found, or I should say you found us, I was so excited to finally see kind of this regional connection with these universities. And we were up at their lab, and we met with some of the students and saw some of the projects that they were working on. And I was he had to keep calling me down. And it was just, a kid in a candy store. So I really
was very excited to actually identify Washington Traffic Safety Commission. And I was very excited to see your talk as well. I would invite you to talk to our graduate students, give them some good idea about the kind of research that...
Oh, yeah, I forgot to tell you.
A few other things coming.
Okay, so...
yeah.
Any other questions? So I have a closing remarks at the ITS symposium in Seattle. Maybe I will put some cards on the table and I have to leave.
Yes.
Yeah, so feel free to contact me. Actually, I appreciate your contact because an important goal of our center is try to set up a collaboration platform. And having a good connection with the local partners is what we want. So we will not consider that a burden because the lab actually holds a lot of different people from kindergartners to high school students to high school teachers. So that's the way we generate impact and try to deliver our technology to the right users. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
As you know, you gave us permission to seek an upgrade to our distracted driving bill. The governor's office agreed with you, and we sponsored agency request legislation. It did well, but it did not pass. It passed out of the Senate and was, every time it got reset, made it to the floor again of the Senate, but did not make it out of the House. We had some really fantastic prime sponsor, Senator Rivers, was tenacious on it and really kept pushing it and trying to find a way to make it through. So we really appreciated that. We would be happier if we had a bill that would allow our law to be enforced better and provide us the federal funding we would seek. But that's what that is right now. The impaired driving bill 1276 finally did pass. Hooray. You can see kind of the traffic safety aspects of that bill on the sheet. The governor did veto Section 25, which involved a setup of a phlebotomy law enforcement program. And his point was DOH already has the ability to set that program up, and we don't need a new law to determine what kind of training would go into that. It may not be an issue that just goes away. It may be something that we bring partners together to talk about. We still have an issue with very, very long DUI arrest times, especially with the blood tests as we need. So there may be some solutions that we still want to talk about as in partnership as opposed to trying to do it during the legislative session.
And Shelley, part of that,
please.
Of the veto message there was he said, I'm directing Department of Health to work with, I believe he specified State Patrol, to figure out how we can get a pilot of phlebotomist program. So there was a please go do in there too. So we'll keep Christy on that.
So if I could just add, Chief, I'm just wondering if WASPIC, maybe somebody from the Traffic Safety Committee or whomever would want to be involved in that from the WASPIC, or if that needs to go up to your board, or at least make sure that WASPIC's involved in that process.
I agree. Can, and we can. And I don't think it would be a problem at all.
Okay.
I think it's sort of
we think it would be very straightforward for somebody like the Traffic Safety Commission, or not Traffic Safety, but the Criminal Justice Training Commission to stand up a phlebotomist training program. Very, very straightforward. Already exists. So.
Yeah.
I'll beg her forgiveness later.
What's that?
So without going to board, I said, I'll beg her forgiveness later.
On the back, 6134 is an interesting one. There was a Supreme Court case that ruled that there was a set amount of 150 that you could charge a defendant for pretrial monitoring. There were many, many court rules in place that allowed courts to charge defendants for their electronic home monitoring bracelets or ignition interlock or whatever. The Supreme Court said no, the court rule for that still, or the RCW still applied, the court rule was overruled. So almost on the day that came out, there was a bill dropped during second session, which is really unusual, passed very quickly, and it simply says that electronic monitoring, substance abuse monitoring, is exempt from that $150 limit. So that was interesting and good for 24/7 and good for our attempts to get ignition interlock on pretrial monitoring.
I would say I think we do need to watch this, though, because it was apparent that there's no common practice around jurisdictions. So when we were looking at, okay, how many people are capping at 150 now, there was some testimony that without, you know, because of the Supreme Court decision, then we weren't, you know, we were going to release people without any kind of monitoring. And then when you started looking at stories, it sounded like a lot of folks were already capping at 150 and considering this pretrial monitoring as, anyway. So I think what we need to make sure is, one, is it not our jails not backing up now because people can't afford or don't want to take on the expense in jurisdictions that formerly were capping at 150? And I just think it's something for us to monitor.
Yeah, and that is just so normal in our state to have a very wide variety of how courts practice.
And it's a problem to have a bill in the second session where we have
no time to really figure
that out. Yeah. In response to a case.
Is that something we should have a group take?
Somewhere in there we need to just get an idea of what this is doing.
Okay.
It was very quick and a little dicey. So.
Okay.
Let's see. The other one I'm going to talk about, because time is over, is the Pedestrian Safety Advisory Council. That'll be
before you get to that,
yes.
Shelley, could you just quickly talk about 1087, the traffic safety cameras in school zones? I hadn't heard about that one. And I know it didn't get anywhere, but what was it exactly?
It was a representative or senator, I can't remember now, who wanted, if you were going to have a camera ticket in school zones, a separate flashing light in the school zone that said camera is operating.
Separate from the 20-mile-per-hour flashers that are already there.
So I suppose that there may be places where they have set up a camera in a school zone. I don't know this for a fact, but in my thought process of why this might be something you want, but still has the sign that says 20 miles per hour when children present. So if you had a camera set up ticketing drivers when it was when children were present, that would be a difficult thing.
So the way they generally work, though, at least with the vendor we're using, is that you have to use them in conjunction with the flashers.
Yes.
And they don't come on when the flashers
right.
are on.
And I don't know if this representative or senator didn't know that, or if there isn't clear guidance that that's the only way you can have a camera in a school zone. I'm not sure. I'm glad that it didn't pass, because it would be very confusing, I think, to have two sets of lights in every school zone saying camera's operating and school zone's active. I guess the other question they had was, if you have the camera set up in the school zone flashing 20 miles an hour, and then it's not flashing, so the speed limit is, say, 35 miles an hour, are you also ticketing for speeding at that point?
We are. I suppose some jurisdictions.
See, I think it's just that we don't know. My suspicion is that nobody does it.
You are or you aren't?
Aren't.
No, I bet nobody does, but
yeah.
We just don't have the data.
On the school times, pick up, drop off, that's where our safety concerns are.
Right.
Right.
And that's why pretty much people go to cameras. So
Thanks for that.
Yeah, that was an interesting piece. Pedestrian Safety Advisory Council is provided us with a half FTE to get this council up and running, so that's our next step will be to hire a half a person. I'm not sure which half we're going to get, but it'll be fun.
We're kind of splitting it down the middle.
I am happy to discuss Ledge with any of you. Just let me know, but we're over time, so I'm going to bow out.
Thank you, Shelby. And Darren.
Just a couple of quick things. Our data integration position that we had that was helping us to try to bring some of those databases together and integrate the trauma, the hospital, EMS, DOL, crash data, those kind of things. That person had left last year. We have been seeking diligently to fill that position. It's hard to find somebody with the right skill sets, and I have some good news. August 3rd, her name is Andy Callison, will be starting and be more of a project position at the beginning. Hopefully that she'll be able to help get in and help move us down the road so that we can begin this integration process. It's been a lot more challenging than we thought it was going to be. So I just want to make sure all of you as commissioners hear that we are moving forward because that has been a priority. And I will link into yesterday, we got home kind of late. We were at the National Cooperative Research Evaluation Program. It's part of the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Governor's Highway Safety Association has convened an expert panel on impaired driving, specifically with marijuana, and with the idea of what are challenges for states that have already enacted and what can we do to help states that are potentially have it on their ballots and those kinds of things. And so from our state, we had Dr. Hoff from our office, myself. We had Steve Johnson from the Liquor Control Board and Dr. Fiona Cooper from the State Patrol Tox Lab. But we had California, Colorado, Vermont, Maine. We had folks from Probation and Parole Association, the national. So we had a lot of various perspectives and lots of folks from USDOT there. And this was one of the items that came up as being able to link in. So, because our FARS data itself, when you enter a fatality, if you don't have a supplemental report that the officers put in, oftentimes the officers are not submitting those supplemental reports. So they submit their blood. The supplemental report comes back. Sometimes those are not getting onto the fatality report. So our Mimi Nickerson, our bulldog here, is calling the agency saying, I need your tox results. Unfortunately, the way that the current FARS system is set up is it only takes three drugs, and it may just take it by name, but it does not give you the level. So nationwide, we don't have any way to track like a nanogram level or to see, you know, in fatality collisions what that number might be. So we have petitioned. I actually wrote a letter to NHTSA asking them to go back, revisit. Yesterday, many of the states made the plea to NHTSA to change that, but also to make it unlimited in the fields, because often when you talk to the toxicologists from these fatality reports, there's four, five, six different drugs that are in their system. Some of them are prescribed. Some of them are illicit. So it would be nice to be able to kind of see the variety, because one of the challenges, it's not just about marijuana. It's about impaired driving. And so, yes, we are faced with legalization and with recreational, medical, and those kinds of things, but we need some way to look at this on a nationwide basis. But we were able to participate with that. It was a phenomenal experience. A lot of people from around the country, around this table, trying to provide input. So it was nice to be able to see Washington State being a participant in that arena. We also spoke to a senator from the state of Massachusetts last week with Liquor Control Board. He was very interested to seeing what the issues are, the challenges. He's doing quite a bit of research, I think trying to figure out what kind of platform that they would set up within the state of Pennsylvania. So that was also something very interesting. One thing for the commissioners, as you know, we have a triannual management review that's conducted by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to look at all of our processes and practices and things of that nature to make sure that we're using the federal funds in the way we are. They were here June 22nd through the 25th. By all indications, we look like we've done well. If you remember in 2012, we had zero findings and I think zero management considerations, and so we're hoping for that same outcome as well. Did you want to just mention quickly your new partner? We're going to miss...
Yes, I'm sorry. The new coach, I just got the message on because I got back in the office, is the sheriff from...
Lewis County.
And
Ron Snaza.
Thank you.
We're going to miss your sheriff.
Because I just found out about myself.
They made a change in the committee chairs for the WASP Traffic Safety Committee, and so now it'll be Chief Bill Drake and then Sheriff John Snaza. So you're with
Rob.
I'm sorry, what did I say, John?
It's Rob. That's his brother.
I know. I
the other one.
Don't say anything to him that I called him John. It's Rob.
It's never happened before.
Well, they're twins. That's what makes it even worse. And when I walked up to him the first time, they are identical twins. I walked up to him the first time, and I'm like, hey, John, how you doing? I'm Rob. Sorry. Next time I'll call you Sheriff. As you know, upcoming October 13th and 15th is our statewide traffic safety conference. That will be in Seattle. That will be our next commission meeting. That meeting will only be 1 hour, so we'll have a very specific agenda for the commissioners. We hope that you'll be able to attend so that you can attend many of the various workshops. We've got a great list. We've got 36 workshops already, and staff has done a phenomenal job putting that all together. So that is no small feat. And so that's just kind of the teaser, and then, you know, getting everybody ready. And then in August 27th through the 31st is our Governor's Highway Safety Association's annual conference, which is being hosted in Seattle. So that will be awesome. And they have already predicting that we'll have record attendance in Seattle just on the feedback that they've already gotten. So, because a lot of people have never been to the Northwest. Lastly, I've got some, I don't know if you call it good news or bad news, but as compared to last year, we were at 267 fatals. Right now, year to date, we're at about 258. But unfortunately, if we stay on track, we're going to be pretty much flat again as compared to last year. So, you know, we're trying. We've got a lot of resources out. I've seen how our population has gone, you know, through the roof. I think we're over 7 million now, and so I think that's having an impact. I think the officer-to-population ratio may be also having an impact. We saw during the 4th of July holiday, it was the worst 4th of July holiday we've had in over a decade, and specifically within motorcycles and with, and you have a chart that I have given to you to take a look at. The one thing that I've noticed, though, over the last, I think the last 4 or 5 years, is that we've had zero bicycle fatalities over the 4th of July, if that's any silver lining in the in our dark cloud. But it was really, I think the weather, obviously, we've had a very unusual weather pattern for at least Western Washington. I mean, you know, you tell people you're at 93 degrees for almost 3 weeks, that's like, you're lying. So it's been, I think those, there's a lot of factors that are involved in that, and we'll continue to monitor that. But I want to at least give you an idea of where we were at least at this point, and the continued good work that's being done. So did Etika leave? Okay. So with that, I don't have any other, I've tried to speed talk, and I know we're over. Some of you have to catch planes. So with that, I can take any comments or questions. Or
if not, then we are adjourned. See everyone October 15th.
All right. Thank you.
See you, Glenn.
This may end up being one of our
But again,
Do you have a, and like I said, I'd like for us to, because I